Alrighty. G'day, guys. Okay, we've got Matt Jones joining us today, one of the co-founders of Four Pillars Gin. And in fact, we've got this killer bottle of sherry cask gin to give away today. It's going to be for the best question that's posted there. Just going to hold out to let Matt join us. Hopefully, he'll be kicking around soon. Okay, here he is. Tick-tock, waiting for this to work. Just going to see if Matt's joining off of his own personal, or let's try the actual Four Pillars account. Okay, we're going to try again. Let's try Matt's personal. See if this one works. Just whilst it's going on, if you don't know Four Pillars, then you haven't been awake. Ah, there he is, Matt. How are you?
G'day, Todd. I'm well. How are you?
Good, buddy. Sorry. Was having some tech issues there, adding the Four Pillars account and not your own account.
A little bit. Plus, you know, Australia, we're behind you guys, so. It was always going to be a bit late.
Yeah, that's all good. That's all good. How's life over the ditch mid-post-COVID?
Oh, look, I mean, I think we are navigating our way to some kind of new normal a little bit more elegantly than most parts of the world, which is exciting. You know, you're sort of touching a lot of wood and trying to avoid using too many pivot, new normal, transition buzzwords. But they're somewhat unavoidable at the moment. But yeah, look, we're excited. We've kept our business flowing reasonably well, and we announced 2 days ago. We are just 2 weeks away from launching our new Four Pillars Laboratory in Sydney, which we were. If you'd asked me 4 weeks ago, I'd have said that's probably not going to launch until about sort of September of this year. But you know, things have sped up a bit here in New South Wales in particular, and yeah, we're excited. 2 week countdown is on.
That's huge. Now, look, I can't see your video loading. I've only got your photo, so I'm not sure what everyone else is seeing. So this might be an audio call rather than a video chat, but we'll just plug on, buddy. So for those who don't know, let's dive into that whole Four Pillars story. You know, where did that passion for gin come from? How do you start a distillery? You know, what's the whole background there, buddy?
Yeah, look, so we're probably around about 7.5 years into the journey, 6.5 years on the market and a year of sort of pondering and seeing before that. I can see Carl says he can't see video either, which is strange because I can see myself terrifyingly vividly, Carl.
We've just got a spinning wheel of you at the moment.
It is strange, isn't it? You know, I can add all sorts of emoticons here, but very strange. But you know what? Let's go with content over looks. I don't look that good anyway. but yeah, look, we spent around about 12 months pondering what you could do by making gin in Australia. We came into the category at a time when craft gin was really booming overseas. You could see that the Americans in particular were doing some really inventive stuff. They were rejecting this idea that all gin had to be kind of juniper heavy, London dry style of gin. And Cam and Stu, my two partners in gin, they went over to the States and they hired a convertible BMW on a fact-finding mission. And they drove down from Seattle all the way to Los Angeles. And they visited all these craft distilleries and came back and they were just buzzing about flavor. They were buzzing about these amazing Christian Carl stills that all the best distilleries that they went to had these amazing stills made by Christian Carl from Stuttgart in Germany, these real sort of Rolls Royce quality copper stills. So they came back we quickly ordered a car still. We quickly after that found it was about a 12-month waiting list. And, you know, we spent about 9 months thinking, and I think in many ways the genesis of the brand that we have today was the combination of the flavor inspiration that they brought back from overseas combined with the thinking that we were able to do in that 9 month period of waiting for this beautiful still to show up.
Mm-hmm. And I find that really intriguing that the Americans were the ones innovating on gin. I don't think we commonly associate that, do we?
Well, we don't because the gin category remains relatively relatively immature in the States compared to the UK, compared to Europe, compared to Australia. But what was really mature was just the craft scene over there, whether it was craft brewing, whether it was craft distilling, whether it was craft whiskey, rye and bourbon. There was a real energy around this sort of maverick craft scene that hadn't reached Australia. And really, if you looked outside of Tasmania and what was going on in whiskey there, we really hadn't seen that booming craft in gin or anywhere else, and so that was certainly the opportunity to bring back over here.
So that entrepreneurial story was this literally walking out of jobs, leaving careers, gambling everything?
It was not at first, no. So we've and I think in many ways because it wasn't that, you know, if people could see me, they would see one of three interchangeable middle-aged bald white men who set up four pillars. And the DNA of a startup set up by middle-aged men with kids and mortgages is probably quite different to the DNA of a startup set up with great energy and hustle by a bunch of 20-somethings. Not better, not worse, but different. And I think as a consequence, Cameron was the one who figured out. So Cameron is the Olympian. I would say former Olympian, but he gets really offended because apparently once you're an Olympian, you're always an Olympian. So he okay. represented Australia at the Atlanta Olympics in 96 as a 400-meter runner. So he's the one with the grim determination and the ability to turn his mind to something and make it happen. So he started to figure out, okay, how do we learn to be distillers? How do we distill? He got a little bit of time off. He was working in the wine industry in the Yarra. That's really why we're in the Yarra. And he got enough time off his job to start making gin. And that really was the genesis of the brand. We weren't three people who chucked it all in and started to build a marketing and commercial business. We were a guy who figured out how to make gin and then two other guys, Stu with a background in public relations, journalism, a great relationship builder, a great storyteller, a great connector, and me with a background in brand strategy and brand experience and marketing. So it was really Stu and I turning our minds and investing some sweat in this while Cameron did the hard work. And that sort of anchored this idea that we were always going to be a business grounded in the Yarra Valley because that's where Cameron was and he wasn't going to move. And we were going to be grounded in craft. In other words, make the best gin you can and then hope that the rest takes care of itself.
So once you've created that first case of gin, what's the path of taking that product to market? And did you start with just the traditional dry product or did you start flavoring and looking for a unique angle to start with?
We started from the outset. We didn't want to make a traditional, what you would call London dry style. We didn't want to make a traditional British juniper heavy style of gin. We wanted to make something that we thought embodied modern Australia. That's what Cameron and Stu brought back from the States. They said, look, these guys over in Oregon and Washington State and California, they're making really, this is not a term that Stu would ever use, but they're making gin with a real sense of terroir and provenance. They're making gin of their place. Well, let's make gin of our place because, frankly, Australia is the best tasting country on earth. We've got the most extraordinary local produce. We've got the most extraordinary sort of cross-references of different food cultures. You know, you couldn't think of a place that tastes better than Melbourne. So if we can pack all of that into a gin, that combination of Mediterranean citrus and Asian spice, we took the view that modern Australia, rather like modern New Zealand, it isn't parochial. It doesn't insist on only making stuff that's local. We said, well, modern Australian gin should be the best in the world. So we should find the best juniper we can. It doesn't matter where it grows. It turns out it all grows in Macedonia and Kosovo. Okay, well, let's use that juniper. Let's use the traditional botanicals from where they come from best, but let's then inject things like Australian native lemon myrtle, the most beautiful citrusy substance on the planet, Tasmanian pepperberry leaf. Let's take advantage of the fact that Australia has a year-round citrus season. Let's use whole fresh citrus. And so combining those things together gave us a really modern Australian flavour, but it was get one gin right and then play. To your point, Todd, about going to market, I think what really was in our favour here is a total freak of a sort of serendipity and necessity. We're sitting around waiting for this still. You know, we knew we were going to call her Wilma after Cameron's late mum. We knew she was going to be a stunning gin-making machine, but we didn't really know what we would get out of it. We didn't even know if Cameron would be a very good distiller. And so we started to think about, well, how do you build momentum behind this gin before it's in bottle? How do you build some energy around the story and the sense of purpose? And we decided to run a crowdfunding campaign. We were one of the first alcoholic products to campaign on Possible, which was sort of Australia's crowdfunding platform. And I think at the time it was the third biggest in the world after Kickstarter and Indiegogo. And we ran a campaign. We didn't know how it would go. And we sold the thing out in 4 days. And that gave us our first 300 customers. It seems tiny now. It seemed enormous then. And we said to them, and the minimum, I remember having a big argument with the guys at Possible because they wanted us to have really cost-effective, accessible tiers that people could buy into. And we said, well, no, we think the minimum anyone should buy into is a bottle of gin. And they said, it's too expensive. No one will do it. We said, well, just trust us. We think they will. So everyone bought either a bottle of gin or two or four or a personal gin experience with Stuart, I think, in one case. And we made every single person who pledged a member of the Batch Number One Club. We said, look, you've bought a bottle of Batch Number One. You are VIPs in perpetuity. And here we are six and a half years later. Those Batch Number One guys, we've added a few since then, but they still get first up access to everything. And I think what that cemented was this realization that A, we could make gin that was really distinctive to Australia, and B, we could make direct customer relationships the heartbeat of a brand that we had pretty significant aspirations for, but we thought those core few customer relationships could always be at the heart of it.
And I think that's amazing, that consumer centricity and, you know, still being loyal to that group 7 years later. I think that's amazing. And those guys will be loyal for life now, right? But that must have started a trend in market for how everyone started taking liquor brands to market, right? Because we'd never had that exposure and access to craft product. You went down the bottle shop and it was Bombay or Beefeater. That was kind of it, right? So do you feel that you actually pioneered a whole industry there?
No, but I think we pioneered some ways to get into that industry that have been quite influential since then. I wouldn't have the level of hubris to say we were pioneers, but I think we did some things that were interesting. So one of them was that you can mash together a direct-to-consumer model and a B2C retail model, and it can be really effective. I think you look at a lot of brands and a lot of different sectors, it feels like they have to make the choice. It feels like they have to make the choice between the direct-to-consumer path versus the traditional distributed retail path. And we just could not, frankly, build a viable business if we chose one or the other. We absolutely needed all of those sales. Excise regime in Australia is really punitive. We weren't going to make enough money to live beyond about 2 years if we didn't. And so I remember the first time we went for a meeting with our largest retail partner here in Australia, Dan Murphy's, and we said to them very openly, very unapologetically, guys, we are going to do everything we can to sell gin direct to our customers. And we promise you that the type of person who wants to go onto a website and buy gin direct from the source, and when we eventually open our brand home, who will want to drive out to the Yarra Valley and buy direct from the source, we promise you they're the kind of customer who influences 10 of your customers. So don't freak out. Don't freak out when you watch us pushing hard. We are pushing for a different type of customer. We're pushing for a customer that we might all see as an influencer, someone who's actually going to shape the way the market develops. Every bottle we sell, it's going to help sell 10 in your channel. I think the second thing we pushed was price point. There was a skepticism about whether people were going to be willing, let's talk in Australian dollars, to be paying $70, $80, $90, $100 for a bottle of gin. The speed of the growth of those super premium and ultra premium categories now is phenomenal. Gin is the fastest growing spirit in the liquor portfolio, and super premium and ultra premium are the fastest growing within gin. And I think we helped to break a psychological barrier around what people were willing to pay for quality. And certainly that was a trend that we saw, you know, and obviously COVID-19 recently has only exacerbated this. People are looking to drink well at home. Of course, they're looking to go out and have great experiences. And actually, what's more critical than ever in the experience economy now is the total experience, because we can drink well at home. And once you start to think about drinking well at home, that $70, $80, $90 bottle of gin doesn't feel so expensive. There's, you know, if you pour 30 mil shots, there's 23 of them in there. If you pour the way some people do, there's still about 15 drinks. You'll get value from that bottle. I think the third and final one I'd mention here, a little sort of code of the category that I think we shifted, was around diversity of range. So we ran our Possible campaign. We launched in December of 2013. And in March of 2014, we won a double gold medal for our core gin, our rare dry gin at San Francisco World Spirits Comp. That meant that everyone in the comp gave it a gold medal. And I think at that point, if we had followed the orthodoxy of the category, we'd have become a marketing business and we'd have put everything behind that one gin. Why wouldn't we? You know, we're one of only 8 gins in the world to win a double gold. At the time, Hendrix had well over 70% of that super premium gin category in Australia. They had one SKU, one gin. We now had one kick-ass gin. Why wouldn't you get behind it? But for us, we look back at the purpose that we'd committed to. We talked in that long period of waiting for Wilma about wanting to elevate the craft of distilling gin. You're like, well, you don't do that with one product. So we just pushed on. We pushed on into barrel-aged gin, into a navy-strength gin. Before we knew it, Cameron was macerating local Shiraz grapes in gin. We were collaborating with other people to make experimental gins. And as we grew that portfolio, with that combination of a direct consumer model and a B2C model, what you actually saw was the brand growing. And instead of that fear that people have that these things would become distracting and diluting, actually, the more we did, the more we made, the more energy we built around the brand.
Yeah, for me, when I look at Four Pillars, and I think your Shiraz is a staple in our office, there's always a bottle. I think what is the bit that impresses me when you look at that diversification of portfolio is there's authenticity to each one of those products. And there's still some craft provenance, but slowly the commercialization of the brand goes through there. There must have been temptation, or maybe it wasn't a temptation because you clearly go against the trend, but, you know, to go down that sort of absolute vodka route where you've got 55 different flavors, with, you know, vanilla and cinnamon and chili and all that kind of jazz. So, you know, I think that relates to a question that just came in here of how do you do that market research to know that a sherry cask gin is going to work? Or is it just we like it, so you will like it?
Look, both your question and the one that came through in the questions there, they're spot on, because we are very lucky. We're very lucky that in Cameron and Stuart, we've got two people with incredible palates. And in Cameron, we've got someone who can translate that palate and that judgment into a product. Simple rule is we don't make things that they don't like. I've got taste in other areas. I think I've got good music taste. I've got pretty good food taste. I've got no clue about crafting a gin, but I have incredible trust in those two. And we just don't make products that they like. I think where we've got smart over time is to recognize that there are things that we like that will never become mainstream. So a great example of that is barrel-aged gin. We are one of the world leaders in the craft of barrel-aging gin. We barrel-aged gin in French oak Chardonnay barrels. We barrel age gin in old Australian and Spanish sherry casks. We barrel age a Christmas gin where we distill Christmas puddings made to Cameron's old family recipe. But then that barrel aged gin gets aged in old Muscat barrels. Cameron is doing some really extraordinary stuff with some single barrels. We've got a single barrel aged gin that's now won multiple medals around the world. We haven't even released it yet. But we also recognize that barrel-aged gin as a category, that naturally sweetened, sippable gin, it's not mainstream, and it's not the job of a craft brand from Australia to make it mainstream. So that was actually one of the first product innovations we released, but it remains quite niche. On the other side of the ledger, you've got a product like Bloody Shiraz Gin, which was never supposed to exist. We were supposed to make slow gin because that's what gin makers do. They mm-hmm. they sort of bend the knee to the Brits and they go and find some rather unpleasant slow berries, these little sort of plums that are a little bit sour, and they macerate them in gin, and then they tip a load of industrial sugar in to make it palatable, and they dilute it far too weak, and so it's a thickly sticky liqueur, and no one likes it. And the only good stuff's homemade, but you're supposed to make it because that's what gin makers do. And Cameron just refused, and instead he stole some homeless Shiraz one day and experimented, and something that has become a phenomenon was born. Again, something he liked, but then we allowed, I guess, market sentiment to determine which one of those we backed. So, you know, we're not a market research driven business. We're a craft driven business, but we're not a tone deaf business that says we like barrel age, so you must. Instead, we're a business that went, you know what? You guys are thrilled about Bloody Shiraz. We love it too. We're all learning together how to drink this. We found that Bloody Shiraz and bitter lemon, or lemon tonic, as Fever Tree call it, is one of the world's great drinks. And, you know, that we didn't figure that out until about 2 years after making it. We were just sipping it neat on the rocks and throwing it into cocktails. And so there's a feeling it out as we go. There's a listening to the market. But at the heart of it, there's a total commitment to being led by craft and only putting things in bottle that we are fundamentally passionate about.
So for all of those home runs that Cameron's hit, there must have been a couple of absolute shockers that came across your lips as well.
Cameron doesn't let us. One of Cameron's great advantages is he's based in Healesville. Stuart and I are up in Sydney, so we leave him alone for the most part. And gotcha. I'm sure there's some terrible stuff that he's played with. But I think what's really advantageous is the way we've been able to build a not just a business model but a brand model around a craft way of thinking. So we brought Dan Wilmer, our original Carl Copper still. Proper thoroughbred gin still. We then decided we needed another one, so we created an identical scaled up version. We named her after Stu's mum, Jude, and both Judes have a slightly higher capacity for gin. We then said, you know what we'd really like is an experimental still. And Carl turned around and said, look, we just don't make stills to this quality at that size, at a sort of small micro batch size. And we said please a few times, and then they got an order from a university research lab that made it viable. So we got, at the time, the only still of its size to go to a gin distillery. And so Eileen, named after my mum, who doesn't drink, she's an academic, she doesn't drink, so she got the experimental still. And so she makes 40 bottle batches to the same quality as Wilmer and Jude. And so we started to run maker sessions where we invited consumers to come, groups of 12 at a time, to come and make their own bottle of gin with us, and not what some gin distilleries do, where they invite customers to come and just blend pre-distilled individual botanicals, but to make a gin from scratch. And right. What has become wonderful about that is when Cameron gets some interesting but somewhat weedy botanical that's come in from a grower somewhere, he doesn't have to throw that into a big still, into a production batch. Instead, he says to a group of customers on the Saturday, look, I just got fresh wasabi from Tasmania. I've got no idea what it's going to do in distillation, but who wants to try and join me to make a Japanese gin today? Should we give it a go? Guess what? Of course, everyone wants to be part of discovering a new flavor and discovering a new flavor part. So I think a lot of the best and worst ideas all sort of start in that experimental zone, and then potentially they mature to a little collaboration with a bar, and then ultimately perhaps some of them make it into a full-scale production gin.
So when you've got these in full scale, but you're still trying to stay craft, what's the commercial push-pull in there between wanting to go mainstream, bigger volumes, but keeping true to your roots? There must be some tense conversations that happen there.
I think fortunately, most of this, I don't want to make this sound overly contrived and thought through, but I think most of these things were things that we thought about early on. So for example, we never said we are craft because we're small, and that gin that you're currently drinking, let's call it Tanqueray or Bombay Sapphire or Hendrick's, we never said that's not craft because it's big. I think we were smart enough to know early on two things. One, we wouldn't mind getting a little bit bigger than being tiny, so let's not pick on the big guys. But two, craft is not defined by scale. There's frankly plenty of small batch gin out there that's not very good, and plenty of large scale gin that's really exceptional. For us, craft has always been a philosophy around putting product first, putting quality of product above all. The other way of answering your question, though, has just been striking a balance between exploring new frontiers and making sure we don't get bored with what we've already made. So, you know, you take our rare dry gin, our original gin, we still think that is the best gin and tonic gin going. That, right, with a slice of orange and good tonic, is a game-changing G&T. We've always felt that, and we still feel that. So we have to make sure we give enough attention to reaching new people with that, to telling more people about that story.
And so telling more people, Matt, is that a geographic conversation now? Because, you know, anyone who likes spirits in Australia and New Zealand has heard of your brand now. How do you take that brand global? Did you have to go back to some traditional distribution routes, or are you going to disrupt that process again?
Look, it's the million-dollar question, and there's a few answers. I suppose, you know, at the heart of it is recognizing that we're probably not done in Australia, that what we've done a really good job of, I think, is engaging those very gin-passionate, gin-engaged, category-engaged customers, the type of people who have a range of gins at home. There's plenty of people who enjoy gin and tonic, have no particular fear of that price point, but they don't wake up every weekend and want to visit a gin distillery or go to a gin masterclass or read a gin blog. And we've got to reach them because we think we can reach them with a better product and help them drink a better drink at home. So I think there's still a market there. Certainly overseas, we're in 30 markets worldwide, but we would be a blip on most of those markets, whereas in Australia, we would now be broadly neck and neck with Hendrick's. So it's a very, very different challenge in those markets. And I think what's common about both of those challenges is that the marketing methods, the theory that got us here will not get us there. The theory that got us here was really a belief in what we've always called craft intimacy, the sense that, look, we're a business built on craft, and we're a brand that's built on craft intimacy. We just invite people to come closer, see what we make, how we make it, come to a masterclass, come and do a tasting, come and visit our distillery in the Yarra Valley, come to an event, get up close and personal with the liquid and the craft, and in a way, the job's done. We can't expect that next range of customers to do that. We can't expect that British customer to get on a plane and visit Australia. So we're going to have to use content, storytelling, digital and social in much more effective ways. You know, I think we're very, very strong in social media, but our sort of approach to social media is tell people long form, long-winded stories illustrated by beautiful photography. That works really well for that hyper-engaged customer. That next customer isn't going to give us that much time. They're not going to give us that much attention. So we're going to have to think differently. And obviously that was part of the reason why, you know, we worked with you guys recently to rebuild the heart of our digital ecosystem and create a new website that could do effectively all of those jobs we needed to do to support that growth.
So when you look at that path now of taking a brand to market through digital, do you sense that that's aging down your consumer set? My gut feel is that you're appealing to a very wide swathe of markets. You know, you've got 18-year-olds to 80-year-olds drinking gin now. Whereas when I was growing up, gin was back in the UK in the 90s, you wouldn't be caught drinking gin unless you were also drinking Pimm's. Do you know what I mean? It was an old person's drink. You know, do you think that the whole category has moved down, or the way that the message gets to market through digital?
It's hard to say. I always feel that the question I'm always most embarrassed about answering is, can you tell me more about your target market? Because it is horrifyingly broad. And, I feel that as the brand and brand lead for the business, I should be able to say something very forensic about our target audience. And then I'll head down to Healesville, and on a Friday evening, I'll pop my head into the distillery door, or at least I would have done until COVID-19 temporarily shut us down. And I'll look at the 80 people having a drink in there, and I'll see the most unbelievably broad spectrum of demographics, whether you're talking age, you're talking gender. And the one thing that unifies them is this passion for a good drink? And I think if we then dug into that, we would find some people there who were really quite nerdy about the craft of the gin and the distilling process, and others who just love the hospitality and yeah. love the deliciousness and love that sense that it's something local, it's something world-class, it's something fun, it's something creative. And I think what we're doing is building a brand of real inclusivity that needs to spend more time thinking about what it stands for and what it needs to project through its gin, through its stories, through its experiences, through its hospitality, and less time second-guessing who's going to walk through that door today. And, you know, we're opening a lab in Surry Hills in 2 weeks' time in Sydney. And,
yeah, tell
and,
us more about that. Know, this,
well, look, it's a really interesting exercise. And, you know, you create a hospitality experience and a brand experience on the side of a distillery. It's easy, right? Because this is the distillery. There are now three production stills, Wilma, Jude and Beth. There's an experimental still. Actually, we've just moved a new one in called Coral, named after one of our first employees' mums. And you look through these four red windows and you see all these gin stills pumping away. You see all these guys working to play with botanicals and cut up whole fresh oranges and capture the tails of the distillation to go and turn into pig feed and hand sanitizer. You watch people bottling gin and you're having a drink there. You're tasting gin and you're looking through these windows. And so the brand experience, the window into the brand is just embedded into that. But now, of course, we've got this challenge. We're opening up in Sydney and we're trying to bring a signature four pillars experience. We're trying to bring an experience of a brand that's always been based on craft, but we're not bringing the craft with us. We're not creating a distillery up here. We want all of our gin to be made down in the Yarra Valley. And so what we decided to do is say, well, we're not going to open up a distillery. Let's open up a laboratory. And what do we mean by that? Well, we mean that in Healesville, we have become, and we were very honored and flattered and humbled when in November of last year we were named International Gin Distiller of the Year at the IWSC, really the Academy Awards of the gin and spirits industry in London. Look, interestingly, we've done a few collaborations with previous winners, two amazing gin distillers, Herno of Sweden and the Kyoto Distillery in Japan, and they were both previous winners of that. So I guess we've been keeping good company and we've been getting quite a lot of nods for a while, not just all the medals the gins were winning, but also just this perception that probably the most creativity in gin, the most flavor exploration was happening down at this little gin distillery in the Yarra Valley called Four Pillars. So I think it was coming but not expected, if you know what I mean. And I guess what we saw was that we have really pushed where gin flavor could go. And the opportunity now was to say, well, how can we push gin drinks? How can we inspire more people to make better drinks at home? How can we inspire more bartenders to explore what's possible with these citrus-forward, flavorful, really pure of spirit, but bigger flavor gins that we're making here in this Australian style? I said, well, why don't we create a drinks laboratory, a place where we're experimenting with drinks as much as we do with gin down in Healesville? So that's what Surry Hills is all about. There is my mum's still Eileen. She's made the journey up from Healesville. She's done her 3 years of service down there. So we'll still have small-scale distilling. We're going to have beautiful boutique bricks-and-mortar retail. But at the heart of it is going to be this incredible gin bar, this stunning juniper blue-coloured bar where we will be playing both with classical gin drinks, you know, the best martini in Sydney, but at the same time really pushing where this portfolio, this family of gins can go in terms of drinks. And you know, what we've been talking about for a while and we don't bore our customers with, I mean, my view, and I'm sure you share it, is that brand strategy is something to be done, not said. But, you know, we've talked as a brand, we want to be perceived to be the most creative, most delicious, most well-designed, and just most fun brand in gin. And, you know, what better than an incredible bar with a beautiful aesthetic, incredibly talented bartenders, a little gin still on the side, a great retail store to try and embody those things. So it's a new tool of hospitality, meeting new people, making drinks and projecting what our brand's all about. So, yeah, it'll be a fun little challenge.
And does that become a blueprint for a new arm of the business? Are we going to see these popping up all over Australia and the world?
It depends whether you ask me.
But, you haven't even opened the first one yet.
I think what is true is that if you're truly a brand that is made in one place, you're a Yarra Valley anchored gin producer, you need to make your gin in the Yarra Valley. By creating a concept that's built around drinks, hospitality, design, creativity, experimentation, that starts to feel like a model that you can replicate. You know, will Four Pillars ever get to the scale? Will we ever have enough money in the bank again to be able to do that? I don't know. Will hospitality recover to the point where that becomes viable? I really hope so, because I think all of us need to get out of our houses and have a drink together soon. So we will wait and see. I think the job is now to nail this. I think everything that Four Pillars has done so far has been done exceptionally well with great joy and great care, and that's going to be the important thing. But I think your hunch is right that it has the potential to be something interesting and scalable.
Yeah, and I love that concept of moving experience into, you know, that it's an entertaining drink out. I think we see that in traditional retail as well. That experiential retail is the way forward. So traversing that into hospitality is very natural indeed.
And I think also the complementary relationship between the on and the offline world, the more that you do that is genuinely interesting in the offline world, whether that's product innovation, whether that's experience innovation, whatever it may be, the more that you can then have permission to engage people, to create great content, tell great stories and engage people in the online world. I think one of the mistakes that has been made by a lot of marketers out there is to see this explosion in digital and think that somehow that is a replacement for offline and in real life activity, instead of understanding that actually what it is digital and social can be rocket fuel, but you still need something that's going to get you to the moon. You still need to build the rocket, and you still need to bring things of value into the world. And I think, you know, in our own humble little way, we've navigated that balance quite well. We do a lot of events. We've created great experiences in Healesville. I very much hope we're going to do the same in Surry Hills. We give people a lot of reasons to come and join us and have a drink with us and have fun with us. And then we tell those stories and amplify those stories really well through digital.
Yeah, look, I think you've tapped on something there, which we've been preaching for a while, which is that your digital channels are probably more valuable from a discovery, educational, engagement perspective than they actually are from a conversion and a monetary perspective. One of the things that we've seen through COVID is the conversation around, you know, a lot of our conversations tend to be with CFOs of the value of my digital channel is completely benchmarked on what revenue came through the clicks on that website. We've done this with multiple retailers now where we have elevated their success of their product in store and the offline engagement just through really strong digital engagements and then passing that customer into in-store. It works phenomenally well. And I think in a post-COVID world, there's still going to be a resistance to going out into malls and, you know, that general shopping experience. So whilst that footfall drops, that consumer will still be engaging with product and brand in a digital format and will be coming in as a incredibly educated consumer. Some of the stuff I love about your content is the subtle education around the product and the brand, and without it being too crafty and forceful and kind of, you know, banging the craft drum too much, but still celebrating a high-end brand, you know?
And I think, you know, I know that in the, you know, we said we weren't going to overly promote the excellence of your Overdose team on this call. But I think one of the things that I've loved about working with you guys and you know, an aspiration we had. So we set out, I guess, 12 months ago to build a new digital home for Four Pillars working with Overdose. And one of the things we said at the start is we have to reject the sort of almost like false choice between building a brand site, a brand sort of brochure site, which is glossy and beautiful, but incredibly frustrating to navigate, and building an e-commerce site that is hyper-efficient, converts brilliantly, but actually gets in the way of maybe telling richer and deeper brand stories. And we said, well, we can't choose between those two. We're going to have to find something that efficiently and beautifully does both. And really, you know, and it was really interesting working up front with Ryan and the sort of CX and insights team at Overdose and understanding how do people navigate our current site and how do they want to navigate and how can we Trojan horse really rich brand storytelling into a traditional e-commerce path so that people who come in and think they just want to buy a bottle of Blade Shiraz gin, or people who come in and just think they want to get a great recipe for a dirty martini, actually discover what they really wanted was a whole bunch of other content and storytelling that inspired them and educated them in different ways. But equally, we never got in the way of them having that great core experience. And I think that's been the joy of working through that and challenging maybe some of those false dichotomies and choices.
Yeah, look, the thing that particularly, you know, just passing the compliment back in a bit of a boomerang fashion here, when we tend to speak to FMCG brands, it doesn't tend to be a data-driven conversation or a UX-driven conversation. It tends to be a product perception, and you're right, it either swings towards a brochure and lots of parallax scrolling, or it switches into a highly transactional space. Or probably the third pillar we're starting to see a lot more in there is the personalization space in FMCG, like the whole share a Coke kind of concept. We've got a few brands that are working in that view as well. But we actually took an approach that was very data and UX centric, which we would normally probably only kind of take that core approach for a, you know, big furniture or electronics retailer with 1,000 SKUs where the data was giving you true depth of transactional insights. So I think what you're setting there is a precedence for how all brands should be presenting themselves online, regardless of whether you've got 10 SKUs or 10,000, because the same insights are just as valuable. Yeah.
Look, they are. Yeah. And I think, you know, for us, we've got a dozen SKUs, not 1,000 SKUs, but you know, what we have in terms of complexity is we've got very, very different market dynamics. So you're trying to build one home that can service a market like the UK, where all of our sales are through our distributor, through third party channels, and equally can perform a powerful role in a market like Australia, where we need to keep selling direct, we need to be ticketing lots of extraordinary experiences that we're creating, and at the same time, we need to be influencing a much lower engagement sale in a place like Dan Murphy's. And for all of those markets, you're also then considering the fact that you have a portfolio of digital and social experiences that you can draw on, and you don't need everything to do everything. You know, you can really think about what is the role of Facebook. I mean, when I think back to my consultancy days, you know, you start with this sort of conversation with the client and go, well, let's start with the possibility that you don't even need a website. You know, have you considered the possibility that every digital interaction you need in the world could be conducted on Facebook or on Instagram or wherever is most appropriate for you? And then let's make each channel make the case for its existence. Let's make each channel actually prove that it needs to exist and has a role, and then let's really focus it on that role. And I think probably too many folks out there, you know, in all sorts of categories, what they typically are lacking is clarity of brand strategy, clarity of sort of brand success strategy. You know, you talk, Todd, about the role of digital to drive offline. So often that's hard to track and hard to measure.
It is.
Doing that cleverly requires a real clarity of thought and a clarity of theory that you're then going to test through that process. The data isn't going to show it to you, but what can sort of prove it is figuring out, well, what are we trying to do and what's the journey people are going to take and what would be the indicators that people are taking those journeys we think they're taking. And I think not enough people are going into these digital journeys, whether it's a social media journey or a digital website and e-commerce journey, with that wider clarity of thought around how can these things help make their business successful.
Very good. There was one last question for you, Matt, that actually came in earlier. I can't remember the exact wording, but it was along the lines of how do you feel that other people are copying your market positioning now? I think I've seen one other Shiraz gin on market that pops up recently. Yeah. Do you look at that? Do you engage with the competition, or are you kind of wholly blinkered and eyes down on your world?
Oh, look, I think everyone looks around from time to time. I think the question is, what do you do with that data? I think, you know, first of all, we have a very easy to replicate market position, right? Because because we are still to this day so driven by our craft, so driven by the gin that we make, well, we can't stop anyone else playing with Shiraz grapes and gin, and good luck to them. I don't think they're going to make a product as good as Cameron's, but they can give it a go, absolutely. Good on them. I think we are, you know, and a lot of marketers are very obsessed with differentiated brand positioning. I think for us, our main job is to be better, is to make better gin, better drinks from that better gin, design better and more beautiful labels, be really open to collaboration with great distilleries and bartenders that just keep giving us more stories, that keep just giving us more reasons to excite people by what gin's all about. And I think that's hard to replicate. What I don't want to do is try and sort of narrow us down a path of a tagline and a slogan-driven positioning that is, inverted commas, ownable by four pillars, but meaningless, and meaningless to the customer. I think what we've inspired people to do is push towards product innovation faster. You know, I said at the top of our chat today that, you know, we really came in, we rejected the idea you should focus on one SKU. We made many from early on. And I think if you look at most Australian gin distillers who've started up in the years since we've been going, they've typically followed that path of leading with innovation, leading with multiple SKUs. So, you know, what does that show? It just shows that doing different things is not enough. You can't just rest on your laurels. You've got to keep doing more and better. And we've definitely chosen the craft path. We've chosen the tiring path. The easy path is commit to a SKU and market the hell out of it. That's not the path we've chosen. But I think that's what makes Four Pillars interesting. And, you know, as I sit here and you guys can't see where I am, but I sit here looking at, you know, a bottle of our rare dry gin, and next to it, a bottle of this beautiful gin called Changing Seasons that we made with the Kyoto Distillery. And I think about, you know, we've got multiple new gins that we're going to be launching, you know, even in the second half of this calendar year. The relentlessness of the gin innovation is not going to stop. The commitment to telling better stories about those gins, about continuing to inspire people to make better drinks, about opening the lab and creating more experiences that bring people closer. It's all hard work stuff. And I think that's what's going to make us stand apart and hopefully continue to give us an edge.
You touched on one thing there, Matt. You touched on the label, and I guess that also goes into the shape of the bottle. How much value is that in that continuity of brand message, you know, that single continuous shape of bottle? And was there a logical thought process behind that bottle? Because I assume once you're in, because that becomes your signature piece.
It was and it is. And I guess, you know, there's a few quick interconnecting responses to that. You know, the first is that we decided to start properly. We started expensively. We started with a custom bottle because we recognized that once you make that commitment, there's no going back.
What's the custom part to this bottle, Matt?
Yeah, so you've got the little four dots embossed in the top there. So that's on every bottle. The bottle shape itself is a signature bottle shape. There's that lovely sort of heft in the hand. We wanted something that felt good every time you poured it, not too short and fat and difficult to hold in your hand, but not too tall and slender and vodka-like. And when we then designed a label to go on that bottle, we wanted something that would be what we saw as a modern classic. And so when you look at those original labels, I mean, you've got the sherry cask gin there, but, you know, you go back to the rare dry gin, they all had that same little picture frame you can see on your bottle there, Todd. Mm-hmm. They all had that same four dots. And we wanted things that wouldn't date too fast, that wouldn't feel too of their moment. And you'd look back and go, oh, my God, that was so 2013 when everyone was designing things in that way. We wanted something quite modern, classical. At the same time, because we're a direct consumer-first business, you've got that confidence that you can tell your customers' stories. So you don't have to rely on, you know, if you're worried about that low engagement customer in retail, you're trying to make everything look very much the same. You're trying to make everything highly recognizable. Whereas when you're telling rich stories to people through social media, through content, through a website, you've got a bit more permission to move laterally, to do things that are curious. You know, we made a gin last year for our friends at the Esplanade Hotel in St Kilda, and they were reopening what had been traditionally Melbourne's great rock and roll pub. And so we actually found these old band posters from the old SB that had been left on site when our mates at Sand Hill Road took it over. And so we asked them for some of those posters. We photographed them and we took the glue off the back of the labels and we printed these old band posters on the reverse of the label. So as you looked through this bottle of gin that was sort of a tribute to the new SB, but you looked through the back of it and there was a bit of the old SB kind of coming through. And if we were trying to sell that gin through a retailer, no one would even see the back of the bottle. But because of how we sell and how we tell stories, you've got time to take people through that stuff. So that design and creative approach and that willingness to collaborate, the way we work with artists every year for our Christmas gin, it's become another really important facet of the brand. And I think without speaking too long about it, the critical thing is that you don't get to bore everyone with the care and attention to detail that goes into the gin. But if you can convey that, as our friends in politics would say, if you can dog whistle that attention to detail, that care about craft through other touch points, through design, through the quality of the printing of the label, through the storytelling, through the design of your spaces, then you're actually conveying the fact that you care deeply. A brand I always talk about with this is Aesop. You walk into an Aesop store and you get a sense of the quality that's gone into the product because you're experiencing the quality that's gone into the architecture, the interior design, every small bit of visual merchandise. So everything communicates, and I think labels and design are a big part of how we communicate our values.
I must admit, I've been drinking a gin for a couple of years, and I'd never actually noticed that on the top of the label, you've actually got the year, and I've actually even got a bottle number on here.
Yep.
And then again, strangely, even just having that bottle number in front of me convinces me that it was that valued the price that I paid for the product, because I now feel it was made just for me, and that was my special bottle.
That's exactly right, and that goes to, you know, we talked about craft earlier and how you scale craft, and I think it's often about holding on to those small things, those details, those things that the commercial brand manager says, you know what, Matt, that's a bit expensive. Let's stop doing that. We don't need to do that. Craft says, yeah, I know we don't need to, but we want to. It's important to us. It's part of what makes us what we are, so we're not going to stop.
Well, I think that leads me into my last question for you, Matt, because we're 53 minutes into 30. I was really interested is, at what point does the liquor industry break craft? And the reason I ask that is I've seen that through, you know, Kiwi brands like 42 Below, that was an absolute rock star of a Kiwi brand and is now kind of, I feel it's in the doldrums as a brand. I think if we looked at the craft beer market, you know, I remember 3 years ago, we flew down to Wellington to go to, you know, craft beer festivals. And then all of a sudden it started becoming mainstream. You'd started seeing craft beer on tap at bars. And it was, again, it's that struggle between commercialism and them staying on trend and staying relevant. Do you see that in today's economy that the big macro industry will eventually break the craft industry and it stops you being so appealing to the mainstream? And how do you fight that, I guess?
I guess it depends on ultimately what you care about, right? And I don't know enough about beer to comment. I do know that everyone in the craft beer industry cares deeply about craft beer. I get very upset every time a craft brewery gets taken out by a bigger brewer. Then there's these howls of anguish. I think, you know, there's two ways to look at your question. One is, when does craft get broken by commercial? The other is, when does the craft industry improve the commercial industry? You know, when does the quality of product elevates so much from the larger players that actually some of the role that the craft players is negated. I think at the end of the day, craft is always going to be about a combination of quality and innovation, and the bigger commercial players are going to be about consistency and scale. And, you know, four pillars will go well as long as we can combine those two. Because if everyone in Australia can walk into a bar or a bottle shop and go, oh, thank goodness, they've got four pillars, they've got rare dry gin, I can have that gin and tonic that I know and love. And at the same time, that more passionate customer can walk into their independent bottle shop or can go onto our website or come into a laboratory or a distillery and go, oh, there's the pub gin they made for the SB, or there's the Japanese gin they made, or there's the latest vintage of bloody Shiraz. If we can navigate those two, then there's no reason why a bigger commercial player would ever eliminate our reason for being. But I think that balance is what everyone's ultimately looking for, that consistency and that availability combined with the quality and the sense of energy and creativity and innovation. And in theory, if you build a craft business right, you should hopefully be able to continue to achieve that.
Amazing, Matt. Amazing. Thank you so much for sharing so transparently all those pieces.
Well, mate, thank you for having my podcast on your IGTV.
There you go. We did say that we'd give away this bottle. I reckon we give it to good old mate of mine known as SND for asking that good question about market research. He's a good Kiwi boy who's moved over to Melbourne, so we'll hook him up.
Yeah, I second that one.
Thank you again. Super appreciate your time. Have a wonderful weekend. We're having a long weekend here, so we'll be drinking gin. You're on a long weekend.
Enjoy.